Hi, everybody. My name is Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Chuck and Loretta for asking me to speak here tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege for me to share my experience, strength, and hope at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA, and that's something I always say because it's something I always need to remember. There was a time in my life, if anybody ever told me I'd be telling you honestly about who I was, I would have thought you were crazy. My drinking took me to the gates of hell, and I never thought I'd be able to stay sober, not even for a single day. So the fact that I'm standing here and I haven't had a drink is a miracle, and it's just a proof that this program works if you work it. I need to qualify. My sobriety date is January 12, 2001. I have a sponsor. I work the steps to the best of my ability, and I'd really kind of like to make this my home group. I really like the way you guys do it. It's really a fun time. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, but I really want to preface my story by saying if I had gotten what I want, I'd definitely still be drinking. If I'd gotten my way, I'd probably be dead, and I'm just grateful that I never got what I actually deserved. I'm originally from New Jersey. I'm 45 years old. I come from an Irish Catholic background, which kind of predisposes me to the whole concept of drinking is fun, drinking is social. I grew up in a house where, although my parents didn't drink at home, every time there was parties, there was always alcohol. And as a small child, I always equated drinking to a social event. You know, I used to watch my aunts and uncles get together at parties, and they'd have a couple of drinks, and everybody got a little looser, and everybody got a little funnier, and everybody started singing. And I always thought that alcohol was how you had a good time. As a kid, I was the third child out of four. I was painfully shy. I was afraid of everything. I still am. I'm really just that same fearful little girl that I always was. And I'm afraid standing here today. I really don't like sharing. I always get very, very nervous, so bear with me. I'll loosen up a little bit. But I always kind of equate it to, I always feel like I'm going to throw up and wet my pants at the same time. And which is kind of natural because that's what happened when I drank. I threw up and I wet my pants. So I'm kind of used to that feeling, so I'll work it out as I go along. But like I said, as a kid, I was painfully shy. I was just awkward. I had bright red hair. I was overweight. I was shy. I was painfully shy. And I just never felt like I fit in. I just never felt like my skin fit. I always felt like the odd man out. I had two older brothers that were handsome and athletic and popular, and I just wasn't that kid, you know? I had friends in school, but I just wasn't the popular girl. I wasn't the cheerleader. I wasn't the cute one with blonde hair, you know? I was like Alfred E. Newman from Mad Magazine's sister. I had red hair, a million freckles, a big gap in my teeth, and I was shy. I was just awkward, you know? But I always had a place in my family, you know? I always felt safe at home. And at home, I was the baby. I was the youngest until I was 9 years old. And I was the only girl until my sister came along. And when my sister came along, my life kind of changed a little bit. She became the center of attention. She became, the baby. And I just kind of ceased to exist at home. And I just kind of became more of an introvert, more of a loner than I was before. And I'm still, by nature, a loner. It's not easy for me to open up to people. It's not easy for me to let anybody see who I am or what I'm about. It's not natural for me. So AA is not natural for me. It's something that I have to work at. It's not natural for me to get up here and honestly share with you who I am. Because I've spent my whole life lying about what I am, what I've done, and pretending to be something I'm not. And this program has shown me that I really just don't have to do that anymore. As a kid, I remember tasting alcohol at parties that my parents would have. I remember actually physically going over and grabbing somebody's scotch or somebody's whiskey and tasting it and never liking it. I never liked the taste of alcohol. And I still don't. My whole drinking career, I never liked the taste of alcohol, but I sure like what it did for me. I remember my first drunk. I was 14 years old, and it was before a high school dance where I begged my brother to buy beer. And he said, Rose, I don't think that's a good idea. But I was so awkward. You know, as a freshman in high school, my brothers were in the same high school as I was in, and they were, I mean, just everybody knew who they were, and I just wanted to be a part of something, just a part of anything. I was just desperate. And that's what you did to fit in. You know, you'd smoke cigarettes down by the wall in front of the school, and you drank. So I begged my brother to please buy me beer, and eventually he gave in, and he did. And I drank three bottles of Rheingold beer. And what I remember most is after I drank those three bottles of beer, it's not how I felt. It's what I didn't feel. I didn't feel shy anymore. I didn't feel awkward. I didn't feel like I was too fat or too stupid or not funny enough or not pretty enough. I felt normal. I drank to normal. And I know for me, I can't speak for anyone else, but I know for myself that I had found what I was looking for my whole life from that very first drunk. That's what I wanted. That was my solution. You know, people have spent my life trying to tell me drinking was my problem. Drinking was my solution because I couldn't stand who I was. And I think for many years I've kind of fought this suicidal urge inside of me. I've always kind of been somebody who just didn't think I had any reason to go on. Everything was just too much for me to handle. Everything was so painful. I'm so dramatic. I'm such an alcoholic. You know, everything was so intense. And alcohol just leveled it off for me, you know. It just kind of let me just ride it. 55, you know, I was just cruising along through life. I don't have funny stories about my drinking. I'm a drunk from the rip. I truly believe that I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. I think I had alcoholic tendencies long before I ever picked up a drink. And as soon as I found that drink, every time I drink, I was committed to getting drunk. It wasn't about catching a buzz. I was going there, wherever there was. I'm not sure where there is. I'm still looking for there, but I was going there. And it became apparent by the time I was 15, I had my first real bout with alcohol poisoning. I was drinking in the woods with my friends, you know, and I drank a whole bottle of Smirnoff straight down, passed out, had to be rushed to the hospital, had to be revived. And any normal person would have thought, well, you know what? You're not doing this really well, Rose. Maybe you should stop. Not me. I just thought, well, I got to pace myself a little bit better. You know, I'll slow down a little bit. I won't drink the whole bottle straight down. Maybe two sips is better. And it just didn't happen. I knew, as much as I was humiliated, embarrassed, and my parents had found out and there was problems, I knew I wasn't going to stop drinking because that's what I needed to get through. That's what helped me get through. By the time I was 16, I was hanging out in bars. I always looked older than I was. And I used it to my advantage, and I was hanging out in bars. You know, I always got good grades in school because my parents were really strict, and they wouldn't have, you know, tolerated anything less than that. But I always was hanging out in a bar from the time I was 16. I made a point of every bartender was going to know me, every bouncer was going to know me because I never had ID, and that's what I did. By the time I was 17, my father sat me down. He realized that there was something different about me. My father was a bartender by trade. So if he knew anything about drinking, he knew that his 17-year-old daughter had a problem. Like I said, I didn't do it halfway. If I came home, I came home loaded, you know, and that's just who I was. And he sat me down, and I still remember to this day, it was at the dining room table, and he said to me, he said, Rose, you have all the earmarks of being an alcoholic. And I knew he was right. I knew I was different. I never struggled with the label of being an alcoholic because I knew I drank differently. I knew it was too important to me. I knew it was never about being social. I knew it was about being drunk. I knew it was about being wasted. I knew it was about getting past that part of me that was uncomfortable. And so when he sat there and he told me this, I knew he was right, but I absolutely knew that I wasn't going to stop drinking. It was just not an option for me. I was just going to get sneakier. I was going to get better at this. And at that age, I don't know if you guys remember, or maybe some of you are still quite young. At 17, I knew everything. You know, nobody could tell me a thing. I worked. I got good grades. I had my own car. You know, I had a job. I did everything I was supposed to do. And I never could get the concept that I hurt anybody but myself. Never could see that there was a bigger picture. You know, for years and years, I couldn't see that anything I did affected anybody else but myself. And it was my life, and I'm going to live it any way I want. And that's pretty much what my mantra was from that point on. By the age of 17, I was a full-fledged, full-blown alcoholic, drinking every single day. And by the time I graduated high school, and I was a smart girl, you know, I wasn't dumb. But what happened was, when it was time to go to college, I'd lost any motivation, any drive to do anything different than what I was doing. It was just too much work. It took away that oomph, you know, that motivation to be any better than I was, and I started settling for a lot of things in my life. But, to appease my parents, I did go to college. I went to a local community college for a couple of months, and then I dropped out because what I wanted to do is I wanted to go to the bars. I wanted to play pool. I wanted to hang out. I wanted to drink. That's all I wanted to do was to drink. And that's what I did. I dropped out. I got a job, and I liked it, you know, and I hung out in the bars. Every night of the week, you could find me in a bar, and that's kind of how I lived. When I was 20 years old, I not only was this full-blown, full-fledged alcoholic, I'd become a blackout drinker. Every time I drank, I blacked out. Didn't matter if I'd won, didn't matter if I'd 100. Couldn't tell you what I did. No clue. If I drove, who I was with, who I did it with, what bar I went to, completely a blackout drinker. And around this same time, I met a man, another alcoholic. You know, and that's what attracted me to him, is that he drank like I did. You know, he didn't have a little sissy drink here and there. This man drank, you know, and that was good, because I could drink with him, you know what I mean? I couldn't drink with somebody that could have one or two drinks. I still, to this day, don't know how somebody can put a drink down and leave it when it's not finished. How do you do that? You know, I couldn't put bottles down, you know, so that's a concept I never got. And so I got together with this man, and I ended up spending 13 years of my life with him. It was apparent from almost the beginning that it was unhealthy. I think deep down in my soul, I knew he was not my heart's desire. But he was good enough. You know, I'm settling. What the hell? You know, he's a drunk like me. He'll accept me for who I am. And even if I really don't like him, I'll just drink my way through it. It's all right. And, you know, and that's pretty much what I did for 13 years. For the first 2 years, it was all right. And by that point, my family and his family became concerned. They could see that this was just a bad combination. And they actually got together and tried to decide how they were going to break us up, which couldn't work because we were in love, you know. So we ended up staying together, and I was still living at home. I was 25 when my parents finally decided to throw me out of the house and move to Florida. And what I did was I moved in with this man. And I was a drunk already, and I was drinking every day. But what happened was when I moved in with him, I started drinking more than I ever drank before. The amount of alcohol that I was consuming, because now I'm going to stay at home at night with this man that I'm so totally in love with that I have to drink myself drunk every night. And I was drinking about, at this point in my life, probably about 1.75 liters of whiskey every night. Luckily for me, and I still don't know how this happened, I had been able to get a very good job. I got a job with a Fortune 500 company. It was a job that paid me a lot of money. And I got to travel, and I got to act like a big wig and wear suits, and I had expensive things like Louis Vuitton pocketbooks and beautiful luggage. And I had the facade in my life that my life was going really well. When you have money, you're able to hide a lot of all the crap that's going on in your life because you lend the appearance that your life is okay. If you can write the check and pay all the bills, you're doing all right. You know, if you can send people the right gifts for Christmas, she's doing well. But my life was pretty much spiraling out of control. But I just had the appearance that everything was together because I was wearing the right clothes and I was wearing the right perfume and things were good. Around this time, the man I was living with, who had been in and out of detoxes since we had gotten together because he had this serious drinking problem, you know, and God, he's got to get that under control. And he had decided that he was going to go away to another rehab, and I thought, well, that's a good idea. You know, you got a serious problem because my life's manageable. I'm a drunk, but my life's manageable because I go to work, I pay the bills, and when I failed to mention that as soon as we started living together, he stopped working, you know, because Rose will take care of him, and I did because I'm settling for everything else. What the hell, you know what I mean? It's just one more thing in the basket, one more egg in the basket. So I settled for that because, of course, you know, at this point when we had moved in together, his personality changed drastically. He became physically abusive. He became sexually abusive. He became emotionally and psychologically abusive, and I was so sick. I was so entwined in my own addiction that I believed him when he told me things like, I will kill you. I believed him when he told me he would kill my parents. And there was a tremendous fear in my heart that some of these things would actually happen. And I stayed in this situation because I didn't know how to get out of it. I wasn't well enough myself to know that I didn't have to live that way. But he decided he was going to go away to another rehab, and I thought, well, that's a good idea, and he did. And he went in, and he did his little 28-day stay, which I think is the longest stay he ever did. And when he came out, he told me he was going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, oh, my God. But he needed it, right? And he said, would you go with me? I'd like for you to come to a meeting with me. Last place in the world a drunk wants to go is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I'm saying? But I went with him anyway, and I remember it was a hospital, and it was a speaker meeting, and I walked in, and I sat down, and every nerve in my body was on end, and the hair on the back of my neck was standing up, and I sat down and I listened to this woman speak, and her name was Debbie B., and from the minute she opened her mouth, she told my story. She talked about all that emotional stuff I'd felt my whole life, not fitting in, not being good enough, feeling less than, being apart from, you know, all that stuff that I drank about, and I thought, oh my God, this woman is seeing into my soul. How could this happen? I didn't know I was connecting with another alcoholic. I didn't know that was my first real identification with truly accepting myself as an alcoholic. After the meeting, she walked up to me, probably because I was sobbing at the time, and she said to me, she kind of got to me, and she said to me, you know, you don't have to live the way you're living. There's a better way. And she asked me for my phone number, and I gave it to her, and she gave me hers, and she really tried to help me. She put that hand AA out there, and she tried to help me. But what I couldn't do is I couldn't stop drinking. Occasionally, I would go to meetings sober. Mostly, I would go to meetings drunk. And she convinced me I needed to go away to rehab, which I did. I went away to a very exclusive rehab in New Jersey because, you know, I'm very important. I'm a wealthy drunk. And I went away to this really nice rehab. And at the end of the 28 days, you know, where you just bullshitted your way through the whole thing, you got the little chip that says, oh, yeah, you're going to stay sober the rest of your life, which never happened. And I got out of rehab, and I stayed sober for about 2 months. What I never did was I never told my family that I actually relapsed and that I was drinking again. And for the next 10 years, I let them believe that I was sober, which really wasn't that hard. You know, they're in Florida. I'm in New Jersey. You just don't call them drunk. You call everybody else drunk, because I'd sure call anybody drunk. You know, I was probably buying the whole encyclopedia of Hee Haw at 3 in the morning, you know, because I'm going to talk to somebody somewhere. So I just didn't call them. And I thought I hit it pretty well. I would go down to Florida to visit, and I never stay more than 5 days. And if it got too incredibly hard for me, I'd just hide a bottle in the guest bedroom and I'd drink it when nobody was looking. And then I'd get home and I'd get back to my life that was just unraveling at this point. Eventually, I'd realize that I really couldn't deal with this man anymore. The physical violence had just gotten too much for me. And I was about ready to leave him. And right before I was, I mean, it was right at that place, he fell down a flight of stairs and he broke his neck. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, how can I do this? I can't leave him. A good woman wouldn't do that. She wouldn't leave a man like this. And I didn't, and I stayed. And for the next year or two, I can't even remember time frames. I'm still kind of foggy. I stayed with him, and I tried to be that woman. But I didn't stop drinking, and neither did he, because I kept buying him booze. You know, I was going to work and coming home and caring for him, but he wouldn't leave me alone. He would become violent. He would become crazy. So I'd just buy him the booze to shut him up. And eventually it got so bad that I actually found myself buying over-the-counter sleeping pills, and I would crush them and I would put them in his drink so he'd pass out. I realized that I could probably have killed him. You know, I probably could have killed him. But I would do that, and eventually it just got so bad that I couldn't take it anymore. And he was in the hospital. He used to have terrible bleeds, GI bleeds, and he was in the hospital on one of these bleeds, and my mother was up visiting, and she could see how broken I was. She could see that I was just falling apart, but of course she didn't think I was drinking. He was the problem, because remember, he's the problem. I'm okay. My life is good. He's the problem. And so we went to the hospital, and I think my mother actually broke up with him. I don't think I did. I think she handled it for me, and I let her, because that's good, you know. That's good. Now he's gone, right? So now my life's going to get better, right? Well, let me tell you, it didn't get any better. I was still lonely. I was still angry. I was still addicted to alcohol. I couldn't stop drinking. And I just realized that the problem was booze. It's not him. But I didn't know what to do about it. I certainly wasn't going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, because fruitcakes go to Alcoholics Anonymous. These people want to love you. They want to touch you. You know, go with God. Easy does it. You got to be kidding me. I'm not into any of that stuff. So I knew that wasn't an option for me. So what I did, because I was so incredibly lonely, is I started using drugs. And I started hanging out with some other people that I worked with that were much younger than me. They tried to get me to be social, because I was a hermit. I mean, I was a person who went home every night after work and drank alone. That's what I did. I hadn't been a social drinker since I was 20 years old. And I'm 33, 34, 35 years old by this point. And little by little, I tried to be social. You know, I went out on little shopping trips, or I went to the movies, as long as it wasn't before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because that was go time. That's when I started drinking. And one of my friends asked me if I wanted to go out to a bar one night, which is something I just didn't do. I don't drink socially. I don't do it because, first of all, they don't give you a big enough drink. You know what I'm saying? I drank out of 20-ounce Solo cups. I put a straw in it. That's one drink. That's one sip. Done. You know what I mean? I don't mess around. None of this sissy shit where you're giving me a drink this big and telling me, you know, there's a half a drop of booze in there and you're going to get drunk. So I never enjoyed myself. I couldn't drink the way I wanted to, but for whatever reason this night, I was just so sad and so lonely and so desperate for company that I agreed to go out. And it was the night before Thanksgiving. It was November 25th, 1998. And what I didn't know, because I was older, I was 35 at this time, was that it's a big party night now in bars. I didn't know that all the kids go out and it was going to be, you know, busy and crazy. So when I got there, I was like, whew, what's this about? You couldn't get a drink. You know, but luckily I'd had, I don't know, 10 or 12 before I left or something. So I was all right. You know, I'm a professional drinker. I got this, so I'm going to go out with a little bit of a buzz. And I hung around for a couple hours. I wasn't drunk. I didn't think I was drunk. And I decided I'm going to head home. I'd had about enough of this fun. So I said to my friends, thanks a lot. You know, good times. I'm out of here, because I knew the next day I had to spend it at my brother's house. And he's one of those people who didn't think I drank. So I knew I had to go home. I had to get drunk. I had to pass out. I had to wake up, you know, make myself look like I hadn't been drinking all night, which I was doing, and get to his house for Thanksgiving dinner. So never for a minute did I think when I left this bar that I wasn't in any condition to drive. You know, I was a professional drinker. I can drink and drink and drink. So I walked to my car, I put the key in the ignition, and I started to drive home. And I lived 18 miles from where the bar was located, and I almost made it all the way home. I was literally around the corner from my apartment, and I was smoking a cigarette, and I dropped my cigarette. And when I bent over to pick up my cigarette, I hit something. And my whole windshield imploded, and I panicked. I just panicked. And what I thought was, oh, my God, I hit a deer. I lived in a very rural part of northwest New Jersey, and deer were around. I mean, bear were around. It was just a farmy kind of country area. No sidewalks, no streetlights. And it was a rainy night, and the part of me that wasn't panicked, the part of me that was clear said, you better get out of here because the police department was about 100 yards up on the left-hand side. And even though I didn't think I was drunk, I'm sure the cops would have another story. And I knew that I'd been using some drugs that night, and I had some drugs on me as well. So I didn't stop. I didn't check. I turned the corner. I drove into my apartment complex. I parked my car, and I went inside. It was raining, so I knew I had to cover my windshield. I called up a friend of mine. Actually, I was talking to him on the computer, and he said, I got a tarp, Rose. I'll come over. I'll cover it. No problem, because I was worried about my car getting damaged. And in about 10 minutes, oh yeah, I'm really materialistic and superficial. And in about 10 minutes, he came over, and we walked over to my car. And when we went to cover the windshield, on the windshield, in the upper corner of the windshield, was a chunk of a human forehead and a piece of hair. And I panicked. I said, oh my God, what did I do? What did I do? So I said, take me back. And it was literally right up the street. And as soon as he turned the corner and we drove up the street, I could see the cop cars and I could see the ambulance, and it became really clear to me something horrible has happened here. And I did it. And I left. And now I'm going to leave again because I got this guy with me who's got nothing to do with this, and I can't involve him in this. So I said, turn around and take me home, and he did. And he dropped me off, and I walked inside, and being the good alcoholic I am, I started drinking. I knew they were going to find me. I never hid my car. I never ran. I just sat and I waited. I knew the cops were going to come. And several hours later, there was a knock on my door, and it was the police, and they said, I need to bring you in for investigation, Ms. Eshman. There seems to be some substantial damage to your vehicle. And they did. And for 5.5 hours, they interrogated me, and then they told me that I'd struck and killed a 45-year-old man that was walking in the road. And I never saw him because I didn't stop. I got bailed out of the police department the next morning by a very good friend of mine. I didn't go to the county jail that night, but I knew when I walked back into my apartment, I knew my life was never going to be the same. I knew it was over. I knew the jig was up. I knew my drinking had taken me to a point of no return. I knew that the only thing left to do was to kill myself, because whatever's going to happen is big. It's serious, and there's no way I can handle this. And I went on a mission to do that. What my family was able to do was convince me that I needed to get psychiatric help. And I needed to get an attorney, and I did both those things. I got an attorney, and I checked myself into a psychiatric ward. And I stayed there for 11 days, and then at the end of that, they said, you're not well enough to go home by yourself, because I still was suicidal. And they convinced me to go into a crisis center for adults, which is like a residential home, where there's counselors and other people who are having issues, probably not as serious as mine, but that's serious to them, and that's what I did. What I proceeded to do was have an affair with my counselor, and half-heartedly attempted AA, but he quickly became my higher power. 6 weeks after I was released, I moved in with him. And I tried to pull my life back together. I tried to go back to work, but I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do the things that I used to do so effortlessly. I just wanted to die. And I started drinking. I started drinking worse than I ever drank before. And he told me, you can't continue to drink and live with me, Rose. And he threw me out, and I had nowhere to go. And I got on a plane, and I came to Florida to live with my parents. It's technically called bail jumping. You're not allowed to leave one state when you're on bail, but I did it because I had nowhere to go. I had some monies left, but I couldn't work anymore. I didn't have a job, and I was just on that mission. This is it. I can't do it. And I was absolutely convinced that I would come down to Florida, I would find a way to get drunk, and I would find a way to kill myself. My parents made that virtually impossible. My father was on me like white on rice. And my brother-in-law had recently found sobriety. He had a drug and alcohol addiction. And one night we were sitting at dinner at my parents' house, and he said, Rose, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you come with me? The last thing in the world I wanted to do was go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to curl up in a corner and just die. But I didn't think I had much of a choice because my father looked at me and said, baby, I don't think you have a choice. So I was afraid of him for a long time. And so I did. I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Florida, and I couldn't even pick up my head. I couldn't look anybody in the eye. I sat and I cried, but I kept going. I went every night for 3 weeks, and I couldn't even say anything, but my name is Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. That's all I could say. Eventually, I started to feel better. I got sober, and I thought, well, gosh, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can get through this. Maybe it's not that bad. But unfortunately for me, I decided to get back involved with this man who threw me out of his home, and I started making trips back and forth to New Jersey. Eventually, I got a call from my sister in September of 2000, and she said, "Dad's really sick. You got to come home." And I flew right back home. And within a very short period of time, my father passed away. But I was sober, and that's a blessing. I got to say all those things I needed to say to my father before he died, and he got to see his daughter sober for the first time since she was a teenager. You know, but as soon as my father was buried and I helped my mother get her life organized, I went back to New Jersey because I was about to finish off the last 3 months of freedom I had because I knew I was scheduled to go to trial in January. And that's what I did. I got on a plane and I flew back to New Jersey, and I don't think my feet were on the ground when I started drinking again. And I started putting anything in my body that would numb me. It didn't matter. In a very short period of time, actually longer than I thought was possible, the man I was living with realized that I was drinking again. If you ask me, he's a little slow. And so I don't know how you couldn't know, but okay. And he eventually said, "If you drink one more drink, Rose, I will put you back on a plane and I will send you to Florida." So he went to work and I went to the liquor store. You know, hello, of course I'm going to drink. Nobody's going to tell me not to drink. That's what I wanted to do. I couldn't deal with my life. I just wanted to die. I was drinking to die. And sure enough, he came home, and the next morning I was on a plane back to Florida. And as soon as I landed on the ground, my sister picked me up at the airport with my AA sponsor, and she said, "How you doing?" I said, "Not too good. How are you?" She goes, "A little better than you." And I told her, "I think I'm pregnant." I don't know where the words came from, but I thought I was, and that's the only time I ever actually admitted it. As soon as I got back down here, I started attending AA every single day. And after every single meeting, I got drunk. It is a horrible existence to be in this program and not be sober. It is a horrible existence to pretend that you are a sober person and know as soon as 8:59 hits, 9 o'clock hits, you're gone and you're home and you're getting drunk, and that's what I did. Eventually, it came time to go back to New Jersey for trial, which was in January of 2001, and that is my sobriety date. Not by choice, but certainly I had nothing to do with it. I got on a plane, and I came to New Jersey, and I stood trial. During the course of my trial, which was 3 weeks long, I had a miscarriage, which is a blessing. It's just one of those examples about how my higher power takes care of me and does for me what I'm not able to do for myself, because I never gave this child a chance. I never stopped drinking. I never stopped drugging because I didn't know how to do it. I wasn't willing to be honest. I wasn't willing to do the things that were suggested to me. At this point, I again was devastated. I had already killed a man, and now I've killed this innocent child. What a piece of garbage am I, you know? So after 3 weeks, the verdict came in, and I was found guilty. I was found guilty of death by auto. I was found guilty of leaving the scene of the accident, and I was found guilty of less than 50 milligrams of marijuana. And I was sent to the county jail to wait for sentencing. I knew I could be bailed out on bond awaiting my sentencing, and I called my mother up, and I begged her to please get me out of jail. Please do it. Please. And then she kept saying no, and I kept hanging up on her and calling her again and hanging up on her and calling her again. And saying things like, "If this was one of your sons, you'd get him out of jail." And they wanted $50,000 cash. They wouldn't do a bond, and they wouldn't do property. It had to be cash. And I don't know why I thought my mother had $50,000 in her pocketbook, but I did. And eventually she showed up at the county jail, and she said some very powerful words to me. She said, "Rosellen, I love you, but I'm going to save your life. I'm not getting you out of jail." And she didn't. She let me sit there for 4.5 months. In June of 2001, I was sentenced to 12 years and 30 days. 8 days later, I was shipped off to the only female penitentiary in the state of New Jersey. There's only one. And when I got there, I was certain that I would never be able to survive the experience. When you get into prison, they shove you in a gymnasium with 63 other outstanding citizens, and they don't sort you out. They don't say, you know, "You're a nice woman who's lived a good life." They just dump you in a room, and you're there with other women waiting to be classified. When they finally classified me, they put me in the maximum security part of the prison for the first 3 years of my sentence, because in New Jersey, death by auto is a violent crime. Your car becomes your weapon. And I had to serve at least half of my mandatory minimum sentence in maximum security, and that's what I did. I slept, I ate next to some of the most hardened criminals in the state of New Jersey, and I stayed really angry. I stayed really pissed off. I couldn't wait to get out because I was planning that first drink in 12 years and 30 days. I knew what I was going to buy. I knew where I was going to put it. And I was just a disaster waiting to happen. After 3 years, I was classified into the minimum security part of the prison, which was very different. I had not seen trees. I had not seen any form of life. I saw cars. I saw things I had not seen ever before. And I got involved in a program called Puppies Behind Bars. It's a program where inmates raise dogs for law enforcement, which is such an insane concept to me. It is. You're taking criminals, hardened criminals, and having them raise animals to work with cops. Okay. I'm game, you know what I mean? And so I thought, well, maybe this can help me. I haven't seen an animal. I haven't seen any form of life in so long. Maybe this will distract me from myself because I was still suicidal. I was still so angry. And I started working with dogs, and I realized, oh, my God, I loved it. I loved it. It gave me a purpose. It just got me out of my own way. It got me thinking about something else instead of myself. And for the first 4.5 months in this program, I worked with other dogs, and then I got my own dog. And from the moment they put this 8-week-old black Labrador retriever in my arms, it was love. And that was a feeling I hadn't felt in years. I hadn't allowed myself to feel anything because I put these walls up around me to protect myself. You know, but inside of those walls is all that fear and all that hurt and all that abandonment, all that anger and all that loneliness, because it stays in there with you. You know, and this dog just melted all that stuff away. And I realized, oh, my God, there's got to be some other way to live. There's got to be a better way. Because if I'm still this angry and I'm still suicidal and I'm not drinking and I'm not drugging and I haven't had anything in 3 years, then the problem's got to be me. And I'd had a very good friend of mine. I only had one friend in Florida, really, come to see me when I was in the maximum security part of the prison. And she brought me all this AA literature, which I wanted nothing to do with. I shoved it under my bunk, you know, this, yeah, whatever. And I thought, well, maybe let me pull this out. Let me see if it can help me. And I started reading the big book. And I started going to AA meetings in prison. And I started to realize that there was a chance that I didn't have to live like I was living. I realized that the problem was me. The problem had always been me. And I did the best I could under the circumstances I was in to work a program, which is hard. It's hard in prison. It's not like out here. You just don't have the support system that you have. Eventually, in 2007, I became eligible for parole, which I wasn't going to get, of course, because I've convinced myself that nobody's going to let me out. You know, I'm the worst of the worst person. But for whatever reason, the New Jersey State Parole Board decided to grant me parole, and they allowed me to come via the Interstate Compact to Florida, which was a blessing because I would have gone to a homeless shelter in New Jersey. I had nothing. And I was able to come down here, and I was reunited with my family. I remember being dropped off at Newark Airport by my brother, and the only thing I had in the world was a pair of sweatpants, a T-shirt, and a khaki coat that said inmate. And I remember him handing me my packet with my airplane ticket and my ID, and he gave it to me and a pack of cigarettes, walking out of his vehicle, walking to the airport, lighting a cigarette, taking my coat off that it said inmate and shoving it in the garbage and getting inside the airport, only to realize that I didn't know what to do. I had not been alone, not shackled, not handcuffed, not watched, not told what to do in so long. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to check in for a flight. I used to travel on business. I didn't know how to do something that simple. You know, so I approached the security checkpoint, and these two women in front of me were just bitching. They had to take their shoes off to go through a metal detector. Well, let me tell you something. I'm used to getting stark naked, bending over, spreading and coughing. So if you're not going to do it, I'll get naked and walk right through here. So I was ready. So I did. I got through. They didn't want me naked, but I got through. And I got on a plane, and I came to Florida. And I was reunited with my family, which was incredible. I can't tell you the joy in my heart. But I immediately knew I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to live without drinking. And I knew AA had to be a part of that. One of the conditions of my sentence was that when I was released from prison, I lost my license for 15 years. So not only was I faced with the restraint of not being able to drive, I was faced with a felony conviction, which makes it almost impossible to find a job. And filled with fear. So I knew I had to get to the rooms of AA. I remember the very first meeting I went to, the very first person I saw when I opened that door was the woman who had visited me in New Jersey and brought me the AA material. That's my higher power right there. And all I knew what to do. I didn't know how to do anything but just keep going to meetings, and I just kept going to meetings. It's not easy for me to share. It's not easy for me to put my hand up, but I did it. I told them I was new. I told them I just got out of prison, and I started looking for a sponsor. And I found this woman who had what I wanted. But I was sure she wouldn't want anything to do with me because I'm a piece of garbage. But I was wrong, because it's that alcoholic thinking that screws me up all the time. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy of anything good. And when I asked her, would you help me? Would you be my sponsor? She said to me, Rose, I was hoping you would ask. And she put that hand of AA out one more time. And she tried to help me get out of my own way. It was tough finding a job. I had a really difficult time. I had a good job for a short period of time, and I got laid off, and then all that fear set in my heart again. I'll never find a job. No one will hire me. Dunkin' Donuts wouldn't even let me pour coffee. But I only knew how to keep going to meetings. I only knew to do what I was told to do, not to drink, because I don't know how to live one day at a time without a drink. I don't know how to do it. Eventually, a woman in the program offered me a job. And I went from answering her phone in her pizzeria to managing her pizzeria every day, and that's a blessing. And that's just because I did the next right thing. I love this program. I'm really short on time. I could probably talk for an hour about how grateful I am. I'm grateful that I know the only problem I have today is me. I'm grateful to know that the solution is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for all the things that I didn't get. I'm so grateful. I'm grateful for all the things that I thought I wanted, all the things that I thought I needed, and my higher power just had a better plan for me. I'm grateful that I don't have to pick up a drink today. That is a freedom I never thought was possible for me. I drank to die, and I will drink to die again. That is who I am. I'm still that same alcoholic. I'm one drink away from the hell that I lived every single day. Some days I don't do anything right except I don't drink. You know, I do things that are unnatural for me. It is not natural for me to be honest with you. I am a liar. It is not natural for me to do the next right thing. But over time, I find that it becomes naturally part of who I am. The answer is in the steps. The freedom is in the program. I just keep coming because I don't know where else to go. The only thing that has ever made sense in my life is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new or you're coming back, just keep coming. Eventually, you'll see the fruits of your labor. Eventually. You're going to find the joy in your heart that I find. The freedom in not having to depend on a substance to get through my day is something I never thought possible, something I never thought I'd want. And my sobriety is something that I had absolutely no responsibility for. I was given the gift of desperation. I had nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. And I have a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. The promises did come true for me. I do know a new happiness, a new freedom. You know, those fears... Although I still have tremendous fear, I just do it anyway. It's like speaking at a meeting. I don't like to tell you all my dirty laundry and tell you who I am, but I do it because I don't want to drink today. I do it because maybe somewhere somebody will hear something that might stop them from picking up a drink. The thing I love most about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that your heart speaks to my heart, and that is the only thing that has ever worked for me. Thank you for letting me share.